It's nearly 12 o'clock and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT on 100.1 FM. It's your public radio station, broadcasting from Kodiak, Alaska, up here on Signal Hill, where it is 57 degrees at the airport, 61 according to our temperature thermometer on the tiny porch behind the station. We are looking for partly sunny skies for the rest of the day, mostly cloudy skies tonight, and patchy fog tomorrow after 10 a.m., but partly sunny skies for then, too. High near 63 today, 64 tomorrow, overnight low of 50. Coming up on the Midday Report, the Kodiak Emergency Operations Center has announced a double-digit increase in COVID cases. The Alaska Supreme Court has upheld the conviction of a fisherman fined for fishing in what they say is an area that should be covered by tribal sovereignty. And Senator Murkowski raising up a little dust over the road that should be being built from King Cove to Cold Bay.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Bipartisan Senate negotiators say they have reached a deal on an infrastructure package. NPR's Claudia Grisales reports the Senate could move forward with a procedural vote on the plan tonight.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer told reporters that he believes he has the votes to take up the deal.
Tonight, I'm intending to call a vote to move to proceed to the bipartisan infrastructure bill. I believe we have the votes for that. And we will then proceed to do amendments and go forward on that bill.
Ohio GOP Senator Rob Portman told reporters that Republicans met with Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell and reached agreement on major issues. He and several Democratic senators say they'll next work on the legislation, but it remains unclear if Democrats can stick together on a more ambitious spending bill. Claudia Grisales, NPR News, the Capitol.
The Department of Homeland Security is now requiring all of its employees to wear masks indoors and physically distance, whether they're vaccinated or not. Just 2 months after telling people they could forego their masks indoors if they were vaccinated, the CDC now wants everyone, regardless of vaccination status, to cover their nose and mouth in public indoor areas. Pfizer says a third dose of its COVID-19 vaccine boosts someone's immunity to the coronavirus, at least as far as can be measured in the laboratory. More from NPR's Joe Palca.
Both laboratory studies and studies in people having received two doses of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine suggest the vaccine's ability to protect someone from the coronavirus wanes over time. So the company has been testing a booster dose given at least 6 months after the first two. Pfizer reported today the third dose boosted antibody levels as high or higher than they were at first. They also showed results suggesting that the antibody levels from the booster would not only protect people exposed to the original strain of the virus, but to the beta and delta strains that have been causing a surge in COVID cases. Joe Palca, NPR News.
American gymnastics superstar Simone Biles has now taken herself out of the individual all-around competition in Tokyo's games. This after she pulled out of the team competition this week, citing her mental well-being. NPR's Russell Lewis has more.
The fact that she is not competing tomorrow in the all-around is a sign that perhaps things are not well. It is her signature event. It is something that she won in Rio de Janeiro 5 years ago, and it is something where she just excels at. So the fact that she is willing to sit this one out still says that she's still working on things.
NPR's Russell Lewis reporting. The rock band ZZ Top confirms that bassist Dusty Hill has died. According to the group's official website, Hill passed away in his sleep at home in Houston. No cause of death was given. He was 72 years old. The Rolling Stones' Keith Richards inducted ZZ Top into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame's class of 2004. You're listening to NPR News.
Ang NPR Balita ay hatid sa inyo ng Providence Kodiak Island Counseling Center. Para sa kaukulang impormasyon tungkol sa aming mga serbisyo, tumawag lamang sa 481-2400.
14 new cases of COVID-19 announced today by the Kodiak Emergency Operations Center pushes Kodiak to 51 active cases today, with 1,205 total cases to date. Among these cases, 3 were considered community transmission cases, 10 close contact, and 1 travel-related. There are currently no active cases hospitalized in Kodiak. The Alaska Supreme Court has upheld the conviction of a Metlakatla man who was fined for fishing without the proper permits. As KRBD's Eric Stone reports, this case is part of a long-running dispute over tribal sovereignty.
In 2014, U.S. Coast Guard officers reported a Metlakatla tribal member fishing in a closed area without a state commercial fishing permit. When they boarded the boat, they found a few dozen coho salmon, which the skipper reportedly said he intended to sell. Metlakatla resident John Scudero was cited for 3 commercial fishing violations and fined $20,000 after a one-day trial the following year. He appealed the case. Metlakatla's elected tribal government has long objected to state fishing regulations, arguing that its status as the state's only Indian reservation gives it unique federally guaranteed rights. The tribe filed a brief in support, arguing enrolled tribal citizens fishing outside the reservation's boundaries were not under the state's jurisdiction. The argument goes like this. Attorneys argue the 1891 law creating the reserve intended to create a self-sustaining community, and an essential part of the community's ability to sustain itself is through fishing, both within a 3,000-foot exclusive zone around the reserve and outside that boundary. And since federal law trumps state law, Scudero's attorneys argued that Alaska's fishing regulations infringed upon the tribe's sovereign rights set out by Congress. But the Alaska Supreme Court disagreed. Writing for the court, Justice Peter Mawson declined to rule on whether Metlakatla tribal members held a federally guaranteed right to fish outside the 3,000-foot boundary. But Mawson cited a raft of U.S. Supreme Court cases that held tribes' off-reservation hunting and fishing rights were subject to state regulations aimed at conserving fish and wildlife populations. 3 other Supreme Court justices joined Mawson's opinion. The remaining justice, Dario Borgeson, did not participate in the case. It's not the first time Metlakatla Indian community has asked a judge to rule on the question of off-reservation fishing rights. The tribe sued Governor Mike Dunleavy's administration in federal court last year on similar grounds. A federal district judge dismissed the case. It's now pending in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Eric Stone.
Senator Lisa Murkowski says the Interior Department is holding up aerial survey work that would advance a road in the Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge. Murkowski raised the issue at a hearing yesterday with Interior Secretary Deb Haaland.
Your department was working with the state. They were working with us for 6 months to shepherd these permits. And not once was there any indication that these permits would not be issued or that there was a problem for the basis of the permits.
Haaland said she would find out more and respond to the senator. Alaska Department of Transportation spokesman Andy Mills says its contractor is waiting for special use permits to mark wetlands and identify cultural resources with the aid of a helicopter. It's already completed a survey of the proposed bridge site. Murkowski said all seemed fine until early July, when she says the Interior Department decided not to rely on a memo issued in the final days of the Trump administration that provided the legal basis for granting the permits.
So now the department is shifting this whole process for these permits by telling the state that Fish and Wildlife now needs to do a refuge compatibility analysis and minimum requirements analysis, which may require public comment and review.
A road through the portion of the Eisenbeck Refuge was first proposed decades ago. Conservation groups fiercely oppose it, saying the area is important to migrating waterfowl and other wildlife. The residents of King Cove say the road would save lives by giving them access to an all-weather airport in Cold Bay. Under the Trump administration, the Interior Department initiated a land trade for the road corridor. A lawsuit over that process is now pending in a federal appeals court. Haaland pledged to visit with King Cove residents before taking further action. That visit is expected in early September. As the U.S. nears President Joe Biden's August deadline to withdraw troops from Afghanistan, it's clear that the politics and logistics of getting everyone out of there are complicated and shifting all over the country. Former Juneau resident Heather Barr is keeping an eye on the region. She's living in Pakistan now, working for Human Rights Watch. KTOO's Lindsay Brolini caught up with Barr during a brief visit back to town to find out more about the region.
So what is the kind of work that you do at the Human Rights Watch?
So we document human rights abuses and try to advocate for an end to human rights abuses. I moved over to the Women's Rights Division about 7 years ago. And since then, I've been working on lots of different issues, including girls' access to education, child marriage. I looked at human trafficking. Our approach is always to collect evidence about what's actually happening on the ground and then use that evidence to try and make governments or international organizations like the UN or companies stop whatever abuses are going on.
How did you get involved in human rights?
I don't know. I got really into punk rock music when I was a teenager in Juneau still. It was really hard to buy albums back then, but you could order them through the mail. And I started reading magazines about music, but also about politics. And so that made me think about things in some different ways. And then when I first got to New York, the first full-time job I had was working in the shelter for homeless women. After working there for a while, I was less interested in trying to change the clients and more interested in trying to change the way the government worked and how it was behaving, in the sense that it was making it impossible for the women I worked with to get housing and to get health care and to get drug treatment and to get public benefit and so on. So I guess that's how I got interested in human rights.
Wow. That's I love that it started with like punk rock and magazines and stuff. How is the situation like in Afghanistan, you know, with the U.S. military leaving? How is that impacting like the human rights there?
So the last 2 months have been a disaster, honestly, since President Biden announced that the U.S. was withdrawing unconditionally. The Taliban have really gone on the offensive and tried to take over as many areas of the country as they can. It's been really clear from the way they've behaved in those areas that they haven't changed at all since 2001. So everything you read about before 2001 about how they treated women, not allowing women out of the house without a male family member escorting them, not allowing women and girls to go to school, not allowing women to work, all of that is happening again. That doesn't mean that the U.S. military should have stayed forever, or even that the U.S. military should have stayed longer. But I think the way that the U.S. government has behaved is sort of as if they don't really care what happens. They didn't really do any planning or think very much about, you know, what the immediate consequences would be or what the long-term consequences would be or what this would mean for women's rights. And so I found that really frustrating.
What would you say to people who think that, you know, this issue doesn't really affect them too much because Afghanistan is such a faraway place?
Well, you know, we pay taxes, we vote. So when our government invades another country, drops bombs on another country, that's our decision too. You know, we paid for that invasion. We paid for those bombs. We elected those politicians. So it's not that far away in a way. And one of the things that really gets me is that it's been 20 years since the Taliban were pushed out of power. And in those 20 years, a whole generation of young women and girls have grown up thinking that they were going to have freedom and be able to study and be able to work and walk down the street if they wanted to, and thinking that, you know, this dark time during the Taliban period was a sad story that they heard from their mother and from their grandmother that would never happen again. And now it's happening again. And it's our actions as Americans that, you know, created this sequence of events. And I don't see how we can feel like what's happening to those girls and young women is nothing to do with us.
What do you wish that people here knew about the war, the U.S. involvement, how that impacts the region and the world?
I think when you picture a war on the other side of the world, it's easy to not really imagine humans there. You know, you just imagine bombs falling all the time and things blowing up. But there are also people who are trying to feed their families, or, you know, who have a big exam that they're studying for, or who applied for a job and are waiting to find out whether they got it or not. The way that families are trying to live in Afghanistan is actually not that different from how families are trying to live in Juneau or anywhere else in the U.S. we need to have compassion for those families the same as we would for the one across the road, you know?
Yeah. Thanks so much for taking time to talk to me.
All right. Well, yeah, good to meet you. And thanks again for inviting me to talk to you.
Firefighters are mobilizing to Fort Yukon to battle new lightning-caused wildfires in the Yukon Flats. Alaska Fire Service spokesperson Beth Ibsen says there have been 9 new starts in the region since Friday, including 2 in the vicinity of Venati. Ibsen says the larger of the 2 blazes, the Martin Creek Fire, started Sunday and advanced despite water and retardant drops and smoke jumpers working it on the ground.
A wind-driven fire. It quickly grew because it was burning through continuous black spruce and jumped from 300 to about 800 acres in a matter of 2 days.
Ibsen says the approach to the Martin Creek Fire, which is burning about 12 miles from Venati, shifted from suppression to point protection.
To protect some cabins that are about 5 to 6 miles away.
Ibsen says a Type 3 management team is assembling in Fort Yukon along with 2 fire crews. She says smoke jumpers pulled off the Martin Creek blaze were reassigned to the Discovery Creek fire 20 miles northwest of Venati.
8 smoke jumpers were quickly inserted in there to do suppression efforts. It grew to about 69 acres. They're still working on suppressing that fire. It is threatening a nearby Navy allotment, so they did a burn operation the past 2 days to kind of protect that.
She also says one other wildfire in the broader region is getting a lot of attention. The 37,000-acre Coltess Creek Fire has been burning for more than a month in the Yukon Charley Rivers National Preserve, where Ibsen says a small group of AFS and National Park Service firefighters continue to protect 2 Gold Rush-era cabins.
Making sure that those historical structures are saved.
Ibsen says the Yukon Flats has been much drier than other parts of the interior where wildfire activity has been slowed or stopped by rain. Meanwhile, with extreme fire activity in the lower 48, she says Alaska fire managers are continuing to send some resources south.
It is shaping up to be probably a record-breaking season, lower 48.
The blue satellite dish atop the University of Alaska Fairbanks LV building has long been iconic of the scientific research-focused West Ridge part of the campus. LV is home to the UAF Geophysical Institute, which was established by Congress 75 years ago this week. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the GI started with a focused mission and has grown into a center for diverse research, monitoring, and innovation.
President Harry S. Truman signed legislation establishing the Geophysical Institute with $975,000 in funding in July 1946. GI Director Bob McCoy says the action was motivated by recognition by the U.S. military that early aurora research at the University of Alaska Fairbanks could improve high-frequency radio communication.
But whenever you see the aurora, it's actually doing some, it's causing errors and problems with communication. In World War II, I think HF communication at high latitudes was difficult. So that was one of the main reasons it created a Geophysical Institute. That's why, and so we've been studying HF communication and related space physics issues ever since.
But McCoy says the GI's mission has expanded over the decades, and its largest enterprise today is the Alaska Satellite Facility. He says UAF's northern location is ideal for downlinking data from polar orbiting satellites.
We pull down about 40% of NASA's polar orbiting data. We have some of our own dishes, and we downlink satellite data, and now we're providing it to the Department of Defense. So step by step, we've grown to meet a need. We have capability.
McCoy says the GI's high-latitude location also provides a natural laboratory for a range of experimentation and monitoring.
We have all these cool things. We have the aurora. 90% of the state's on permafrost. 270 miles of sea ice in the winter. You know, 54 active volcanoes. I know our Earthquake Center last year measured 50,000 earthquakes. Glaciers. We got tens of thousands, so it's a great place to come and do research.
McCoy highlights numerous GI entities focused on studying the far northern environment, including the Alaska Earthquake Center, the Alaska Volcano Observatory, the Poker Flat Research Rocket Launch Range, the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Program, or HARP facility, and the Alaska Center for Unmanned Aircraft Systems Integration. McCoy says the GI programs and infrastructure leverage federal grants.
For the last 50 or so years, we've typically gotten about 6-to-1 ratio. So for every dollar we get from the state, we bring in six to seven more dollars from the federal government, from NASA, the National Science Foundation, USGS, and the Department of Defense.
McCoy says that's amounted to many billions of dollars coming into Alaska. Looking to the future, McCoy sees potential in several areas, including unmanned aircraft, and the GI is working with the Federal Aviation Administration to facilitate their expanded use.
The relationship between airspaces, there's manned airspace and now growing unmanned airspace. So how do we do that safely? And they've been pioneering in lots of ways. Soon they hope to be flying cargo out of Fairbanks International Airport, and maybe to work with industry or to work with industry to help them deliver cargo to villages and things like that.
The Geophysical Institute is holding a public celebration to mark its 75th anniversary at the LV building on UAF's West Ridge, August 21st. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Today's KMXT local news is brought to you in part by Discover Kodiak, a one-stop source for visitor information on Kodiak and other destinations around the state. On the web at kodiak.org and at the Visitor Center in the Ferry Terminal Building at 100 Marine Way, 486-4782.
This is Alaska Fish Radio. I'm Lainey Welch. Fish sounds tell what's going on down there. More after this.
Grundin's Deck Boss 15-inch boots feature a protective toe cap, uppers that won't crack, and compression-molded rubber outsoles for better traction on wet decks. Made in USA.
The noises different fishes make can help scientists better understand their distributions and what they're doing. Of the 30,000 known fish species in the world oceans, it's believed that fewer than 1,000 vocals have been recorded. Most recently, scientists in Western Australia recorded 7 distinct fish choruses at dawn and dusk, similar to birds in a forest. The low foghorn sound is made by the black-spotted croaker. The grunting call comes from a type of pteropontid. The third chorus is a batfish. Damselfish are well-known chatterboxes in reefs near Taiwan. Now it appears they've created a new call to help them identify fish of their own kind during courtship. For the first time, recordings can be heard of lionfish, a voracious invasive species that's gobbling other fish along the east coast of the U.S. and the Caribbean. The sounds cod make with their swim bladders appear to have regional accents. Here's the mating call of a black drum. Here's another disturber of the peace, a midshipman fish guarding its nest. A newer undersea sound discovery is fish farts. University of South Florida researchers picked up the cricket-like noises using a glider robot in Tampa Bay. The sounds were most likely groups of menhaden and herring releasing gas from their swim bladders. Scientists believe the underwater soundscape can tell a lot about what's out there and what they're doing. Fish Radio is also brought to you by OBI Seafoods. In Kodiak, I'm Lainey Welch.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Hello, this is the Alaska Department of Fish and Game in Kodiak with Kodiak Commercial Salmon Fishery Advisory Announcement number 25, date issued July 25th at 10 a.m. There will be a 96-hour extension to the current commercial salmon fishing period from 9 p.m. Tuesday, July 27th, until 9 p.m. Saturday, July 31st in the following areas. In the outer Aikulik and Halibut Bay sections of the Southwest Kodiak District, and the Cape Alitak, Alitak Bay, Mosier Bay, and Olga Bay sections of the Alitak District. There will be an 81-hour commercial salmon fishing period from noon Wednesday, July 28th, until 9 p.m. Saturday, July 31st in the following areas. In the northwest Kodiak District, except for the inner Uganic Bay section, will remain closed, and the southwest Afognak section of the Afognak District. There will be a 57-hour commercial salmon fishing period from noon Wednesday, July 28th, until 9 p.m. Friday, July 30th in the following areas. In the Raspberry Strait, northwest Afognak, Shuyak Island, Paul's Bay, Paranosa Bay, northeast Afognak, Duck Bay, and southeast Afognak sections of the Afognak District. The Humpy Deadman section of the Alitak District, the northeast Kodiak District, except for the Buskin River section, remains closed, the eastside Kodiak District, and the mainland district, except for the inner Kukak Bay section, will remain closed. The seaward zones of the Alinchak Bay, Katmai, Dakovac Bay, Outer Kukak Bay, Hollow Bay, and Big River sections of the mainland district, and the seaward zones of the northwest Afognak and Shuyak Island sections of the Afognak District remain closed to commercial salmon fishing. As previously announced, the outer Katoy Bay section of the Afognak District will open to commercial salmon fishing at noon Saturday, July 25th, and remain open until further notice. The following areas remain open to commercial salmon fishing until further notice: the Iziwit Bay section of the Afognak District and the Spiriton Bay Special Harvest Area, also known as Telrod Cove. Until further notice, in that portion of the northwest and southwest Kodiak districts, south of a latitude of Cape Kuliak, king salmon 28 inches or greater in length may not be retained by purse seine gear in the commercial fishery and must be returned to the water unharmed. Other closed waters are shown in the Kodiak Area Salmon Statistical Chart, detailed in Commercial Salmon Fishing Regulations, and statistical charts, harvest strategies, and commercial salmon fishing regulations are available at the Kodiak Fish and Game Office, and of course, the most recent salmon fishery information may be obtained by calling the department's 24-hour record-a-phone at 486-4559. Thank you very much. Good luck fishing, and this is the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
Welcome to your Island Messenger for Wednesday. It's Swedish Friday. It's the 28th day of July, the year 2021. The sun rose today at 5:57. It will set again at 10:33. That will give us 16 hours and 37 minutes of daylight, a loss of 4 minutes and 3 seconds compared to yesterday. The record low for this day was in 1939. That was 43 degrees. And our record high was in 1987 at 81 degrees. Currently a pleasant 57 degrees, rather, here in Kodiak. Partly sunny skies this afternoon. Look for a high of 63. Not sure if we're going to make it. Mostly cloudy skies tonight with a low around 50. Northeast wind to 5, becoming calm this evening. For tomorrow, patchy fog after 11 a.m. But other than that, partly sunny skies tomorrow. High of 64. Calm winds turning to the east to 5 miles per hour tomorrow afternoon. Mostly cloudy skies on Friday with a high of 61. 30% chance of rain on Saturday, with a high of 63. Looking at our local tides, we just had a low tide here on the east side at 11:44. That was a minus 0.4 foot tide. Our next high tide will be at 6:16 p.m. and be 7.7 feet. Over on the west side, and this is Larsen Bay, you just had a low tide at 12:16 p.m. That was a minus 0.4 foot tide. Your next high tide will be at 6:36 p.m. and be 12.9 feet. Mariners, the Shelikof Strait does have a small craft advisory through Thursday. Southwest 25 in the Shelikof right now, seas to 6 feet. For tomorrow, southwest 25, seas to 6 feet with patchy fog. For Marmot Island to Sitkanak, Kodiak's east side offshore, southwest 20, seas to 3 feet right now. For tomorrow, southwest 20, seas to 4 feet. Nominating petitions for 1 2-year city mayor seat and 2 3-year city council seats are now available in the city clerk's office. For additional information, call the clerk at 486-8636. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is seeking interest in establishing a Restoration Advisory Board, or RAB, for the formerly used defense site at Kodiak Army Navy, the Buskin Beach, and Burma Road in the Kodiak area. The RAB will serve 1 to 2 year terms to review and comment on plans and technical documents relating to environmental studies and restoration activities at these sites. For more information, send an email with the line RAB to public.affairs3@usace.army.mil by August 5th.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT three times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m., during the Midday Report at 12:20, and in the evening at 7 o'clock. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.